sitting right here, so I can't just be like, the key is Penguin. Because you would know what the key is, so you could just decrypt it.
Even though the key is, in fact, Penguin.
That is the key, but... but don't tell.
Oh, sorry.
So, here we are, the 10th Elevate Festival, and this is the noisy eating room in Forumstadt, and there's talks going on downstairs all day today, and there's chatting going on, as in all good conferences, in the corridors and across the plates, and I'm currently sat with...
William Buddington. Bill, I work on SecureDrop, which is a... anonymous whistleblowing platform. I guess I should stop and let Micah introduce himself now.
And Micah Lee. I work with The Intercept, and I do operational security and other fun stuff like that.
I'm just going to drop the level down just a tiny bit. You can probably speak at your normal volume, and I'll just do that.
So,
what's happening right now in the exciting world of we're being snooped on and there's nothing we can do about it?
Well, what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow is SecureDrop, and it's a way for news organizations to set up an anonymous Dropbox so that whistleblowers can come along and submit documents to them without compromising their anonymity. And it's all over the Tor network. They just go to this Tor hidden service, which is accessible from the Tor browser, and then they submit documents through that portal, and journalists are able to see those documents and communicate with their sources in a way that keeps the journalists informed and keeps the sources safe.
So can the journalists communicate in real time, or is there kind of a code word given so that you know you're always talking to the same source?
Yeah, so sources, the first time that you visit a SecureDrop portal, you are basically randomly generated a code name, 8 or 9 random words that you have to remember. Then you submit documents, and then subsequently, you go back to the same portal and type in those 8 or 9 random words again, and that way you can check if the journalist has responded to your documents. You can submit more documents, follow-ups, and etc.
So I use SecureDrop all the time at work because we're a journalist organization, and so we have sources using our SecureDrop to submit messages and documents. And I guess one way to think of SecureDrop is a alternative to email where the source can be completely anonymous. Because they can basically just go create an account and then send a message. And then the journalist can come and respond to them, and there can be a back and forth dialogue until, you know, the source feels comfortable to send in some documents. And all the while, the journalists don't know who the sources are unless the source decides to tell them.
How do you install the confidence in somebody who obviously feels very threatened and can't talk about this publicly, but also may be, in fear of their life or criminal proceedings should this information be connected to them? How do they know they can trust you?
How do they know they can trust us? I mean, I think that is... It all just depends on, like, you know, who is running SecureDrop and what the source feels about them. Like, Edward Snowden decided to leak documents to Glenn Greenwald because he was a reader of Glenn's and because he trusted him, basically. He's been reading him for years, and he knew that he was, you know, a very, like, brave surveillance critic, and decided that he would be a good journalist to leak to. Like, he specifically didn't leak to the New York Times or other places that have had a much worse history with that. So, I mean, I think that the way that you build up trust from sources is by doing a good job of investigative journalism and doing a good job of adversarial journalism and you know, make sure that you always, like, stand up to the government or whoever else in power, and just challenge people all the time and have and build a reputation of doing that.
So you have been called by numerous journalists Glenn Greenwald's digital bodyguard. What does that mean? if you know.
I don't know. But, you know, I, like, help Glenn Greenwald and our other journalists use end-to-end encryption properly, and I help them, you know, communicate with sources, and I help sources, you know, that don't know crypto and other stuff, learn how to do this stuff safely, and I make sure that, you know, we keep secret files that need to be secret in good, safe ways on aircraft computers, and that if we ever do need to transfer them, we do that in an intelligent way, so that I mean, it's basically like we assume the worst. We assume that our phones and our laptops are always hacked, and we still make sure that the stuff that we are responsible for keeping safe stays safe, even if all of this stuff is hacked. But at the same time, we try really hard not to get hacked.
So we must assume that if it's networked, it's potentially compromised.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about AirGaps is that you can basically keep them isolated, and so it's not vulnerable to a network attack.
So an AirGap is a computer that has never been on the internet, that has had its, you can't test all hardware, I imagine, but its firmware and its software at least looked at and is open source, so you know that there may be no issues there. It's sat potentially in a different room to any network device. You use it to write your information or record or document, and then you somehow transport that information to your network device in encrypted form.
Yeah, so in the secure drop schema, we use the air gap to store the private key for all communications that are going to the journalist. So basically the public key for NGPG is the key that you can use and anyone can use to encrypt documents. When someone goes to secure drop onion URL, they submit documents and it's encrypted with that public key. But the private key is actually stored offline. And it's stored ideally, and we have journalist recommendations to provide this, that is stored in a separate room without any cameras facing it or anything like that, off of the network and isolated. And using that air gap machine, journalists can decrypt documents that have been sent to the secure drop system.
And not just documents, also like messages. It ends up being really cumbersome for journalists to use. And I think that's one of the things that will be improved in future versions of SecureDrop. But right now it's like, if a source goes to a SecureDrop website and submits a message, the journalist like has no idea what the message says yet, and they have to like go log into SecureDrop, which involves like jumping through a bunch of hoops just to log in to gain access, and then download a encrypted file, and then burn it to a CD, move it over to an air-gapped computer, decrypt the file there before they can see that it says penis or something. And so...
I just gave away my password.
Oh!
So, hypothetically, imagine I'm a journalist and I've just come to you and I've told you that I'm using a MacBook Air and I'm using an iPhone. Is there anything I can do in my daily workflow? Let's assume that I'm low level and I haven't necessarily got the attention yet, because my writing's not that good, of many governments, and I don't think that my hardware has been compromised by something. Should I just still go open source Ubuntu and get rid of all of my hardware, or can I still work with these Apple devices?
I think you could totally still work with the Apple devices. I mean, I think that there's actually a lot of stuff that you could do that makes your MacBook Air, you know, work a lot better for you and be a lot safer. Like, one thing that is really easy and that everyone that has a Mac should do is just go into your settings and go to the security settings and turn on your firewall. And then this means that when you're out at a cafe, it's a lot harder for someone to just, like, access your shared files so you didn't realize you were sharing, or hack into your computer through open network services. And you could also just turn on File Vault disk encryption. And so then if you accidentally, like, leave your laptop on a bus or something, then at least it's encrypted, and people need to get your password before they could access any of the data.
So I use OpenPGP with my mail app. Can I talk to about three or four people who are also doing the same, which is a shame. I'm using a VPN, and I haven't turned on File Vault, and I feel an idiot for that because I wasn't sure that I could do it once I'd started using the laptop already.
Oh, you can, actually.
Suspend it, and then you can even restart it and continue
encrypting. Yeah, just encrypts in the background while you're doing stuff. So a good thing to remember about File Vault is the encryption key that it uses to encrypt your whole hard drive. I guess there's two good things to remember. One of them is when you're turning it on, it asks if you want to send a copy of your key to Apple so that if you, if you're locked out of your computer, because if you forget your password, you're just out of luck. You're locked out. And you can bring your computer to an Apple store and they can help you. But don't do that. Just don't send a copy of your key to Apple. And then the other thing is that the actual thing that decrypts your hard drive is the password you type in to log in, which means that if the password you type in to log in is weak, then that means that your crypto might be weak because, if an attacker gets your laptop and is trying to break in, the first thing they'll do is just guess dictionary words and guess common passwords. So it ends up being that if you want the full benefits of disk encryption, you should make your user password like a good passphrase, like similar to what your PGP password phrase would be.
Great advice.
One of the ways you can do that is use a program like KeyPassX and generate a random passphrase for you, and then you basically go through the process of remembering it, you know, which is sometimes hard. Sometimes it's not as easy. There are also things like dice.
One day there was a hyphen walking down the road and it came across a capital X, that kind of thing. Exclamation, he said.
Yeah. I think I'd have to remember a story because I can't remember even my simplest of passwords. But I do have LastPass for that reason. Mm. And I like the idea of being able to plug in the YubiKey device that injects that 64-bit. It's not half random, isn't it, password?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of the really paranoid basically use this thing called Diceware.
I love the way you say some of the really paranoid, like it's not you guys.
How would you like saying Diceware without, like...
So Diceware is a method of generating passphrases that are actually random and that are...
based on the physical world instead of, you know, your random number generator in your computer. And so you have five dice, which you roll.
Creating a one-time pad.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I think the cool thing about Diceware is that... there's a set. It's sort of like how crypto is supposed to work, where the method for coming up with the passphrase is completely public. This dictionary of 6,000 something words is completely known, and you're just randomly choosing words, like generating your random numbers with dice. And so what ends up happening is an attacker can completely know everything about the system, but you can still come up with a passphrase that's impossible for them to crack. And so if you have like 9 or 10 words in your Diceware passphrase, then that ends up being like 128 bits of entropy, which ends up being like 2 to the 120. It would basically take a massive amount of resources to guess this password, so many resources that it would be impossible for anyone to ever guess it using all of the computing power ever.
At the moment, because as disruption appears to be hitting every element of our world, surely the next step is that very hard to explain subject, quantum computing. You're so glad that I brought that up.
Yes.
Like, why don't you hear that?
Quantum. Okay, so I guess I'm not a physicist. But what I know about quantum computing is that I think that the fears of quantum crypto, meaning that, like, or quantum computing basically breaking crypto, meaning that it just doesn't work anymore, are not entirely founded. I think that with quantum computers, there's, you know, the potential for quantum algorithms that make it way more efficient to do certain attacks, but
So is it potentially anything we're encrypting now does have a shelf life?
Potentially. I mean, there's also technology that people are coming up with that's like post-quantum crypto, where people are coming up with new crypto primitives that will actually be secure against quantum algorithms that you could do right now on classical computers. And so I don't think that it's quite as dire as when quantum computers start to like be in the hands of the NSA and in the hands of, you know, the Chinese government and other militaries and Google and stuff. I don't think that everything is going to be broken, but I do think that a lot of things will have the potential to be broken a lot easier, and that if we do things like increase the key lengths that we're currently using, then we actually, like, you know, right now people use like 4096-bit PGP keys. I think that if you make your PGP keys like enormous, way, way, way bigger than that, it'll like take a little bit more time to actually do your crypto operations, but those actually could be secure against, you know, crazy new advanced technologies in the future.
Gotta love math just for that, haven't you? Really gotta love it. A lot of people are going to be like, but why bother? Why bother? Can you give me some examples, personal examples of instances where you have felt the hand of the security forces on your shoulders or on your laptops? What can I talk about? Do you have much friction crossing borders right now?
I've actually never had an issue crossing borders so far.
Oh, let's not tempt fate. Come on, touch something. That is amazing.
I prepare for it though. Like, I specifically brought a separate travel laptop and not my normal laptop when I was crossing the border this time, and I've specifically worked it out so that when I cross the border to enter the United States again, I'm not going to have any data on my laptop. So, you know, in case I do get into some trouble at the border.
And this is because you are protecting other people's information or primarily your own passwords and the like?
I mean, sometimes I have, you know, information about a story that's going to get published or something, but I also have crypto keys and password databases and things on my laptop. But I mean, regardless, I think that I do things like encrypt my hard drive even if I don't have any data that I care about on my computer, because, you know, I have the right to an encrypted hard drive.
So, like, one of the things in the U.S. border is that you don't have to give law enforcement your disk encryption passphrase, but they can compel you to type it in front of them and log in, and then they can snoop around. So one of the things you can do is, like Micah does, do a fresh install of a new operating system and store your encrypted password database on a server somewhere, and then cross the border, and then once you get there, download it off the server, and then decrypt it locally. That way, even if they compel you to type in your passphrase, you don't have anything of value that you're carrying with you across the border. Just text, basically.
Wow, that's a lot of penises.
I know, yeah. I mean, there's also images, there are penises too, so...
Excellent. You're definitely going to get stopped now.
Yeah, fascinating times ahead. Tell me a little bit about the publication and what you're doing. And where can people find you?
So, The Intercept, you could find us at firstlook.org/The Intercept. It was founded by Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and Jeremy Scahill, who are all investigative journalists. I mean, it's kind of a new, the idea, and hopefully it's what it's turning into, is a new take on journalism, where we want to become one of the big American media players, sort of competing with the Washington Post and the New York Times and other big media giants like that, except that we want to be adversarial to the U.S. government and to other, you know, powerful factions, rather than being like subservient to them, like mainstream media is often right now.
Interesting, you didn't mention The Guardian in that.
Oh well, I kind of, in my mind, I think of Guardian as the UK media. I mean, Guardian, they're doing a pretty excellent job. I kind of want us to do better.
And there's always room for improvement when it comes to kind of not bowing down to certain pressures. And there is a lot of pressures on the media constantly. So what's the business model?
The business model at the moment is we got a whole lot of startup money from a billionaire, and we don't have to worry about money for a while.
It's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, it's a pretty good place to be. And so that's the current status. And so I think that this will actually, it's really nice because it means that we don't actually have to worry about things like business model and revenue for some time.
And can you give any numbers approximately as to how SecureDrop is assisting you with this? What kind of, you know, how many leaks a day do you kind of get?
So this is the kind of thing that I can't talk about. But we do use SecureDrop. We do get a lot of submissions on a regular basis. Most of them are just like you know, kind of wing nuts who insist that they're under surveillance and things like that. But some of them are real sources, and it's a very nice thing to have. And I think that everyone who runs a media organization and wants to do investigative journalism and wants to get sources should set up SecureDrop.
Fantastic. Where can people find you guys online?
You can find SecureDrop at freedom.press/SecureDrop. And you can find me online blogging sometimes at EFF.org, which is where I work at Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have an activism center, and we have technologists on staff. And we kind of use these three fronts to promote new technologies that protect people, promote campaigns that widen people's liberties, and against terrible legislation like SOPA when it came across, and basically protect people online. And we actually
you're funded just launched, with donations, aren't you?
Yeah, so you can go to supporters.eff.org to donate. And we just launched the other day Surveillance Self-Defense, which is a guide that goes into detail about all the technologies and the encryption methods that we talked about in this interview, and
there's
helps people.
There's actually a whole section on securing your Mac in the Surveillance Self-Defense Guide, which, you know, I'm sure talks about File Vault and, you know, turning on your firewall and all that other good
and
stuff.
And a lot of the, like, one of the great things about SSD is that it goes through this process of threat modeling, which means, okay, I don't know how much I should be worried about, or I don't know like how to begin to figure out what my like who my adversaries are, or like what to protect from whom. So Surveillance Self-Defense tries to kind of promote this model of, you know, keeping track of how to approach encryption from a practical standpoint.
It sounds like we need an EFF or an open rights group kind of genius bar in every town where you can take your computer. What could it be called? Something that rhymes with genius. No one's going to say the word penis after all this prompting. But we probably don't want to call it the penis bar, because I think that's actually a piercing. And yeah, you bring your computer and there's a guy you know you can trust because he's out there sharing his open source passions and loves and crypto knowledge. But I'll definitely be visiting that. So, yeah, thanks very much. And can people find you personally on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm at Legend, LEGIND, on Twitter.
And at Micah F. Lee on Twitter.
Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it. Everybody's gone. Sydney got very quiet and good for audio recording.